And you're wondering if it's coming close to that day, or maybe the next day is going to be Penance Day. But you don't know what the penance is going to be. And you lay there and you wonder and you wonder and you wonder. How severe will it be? And what will it be? And how terrible can it be? Because seemingly the longer I was there, the harder the penances were. And I tell you right now, when you look back and remember some of those things they inflicted upon your body, I wonder that I'm here tonight. I wonder that I am even alive. But it's just because of God. God kept His hand on me all of that long time because God intended to bring me out of the condemned van. God intended for me to hear the gospel. He intended to save me. God intended for me to give this testimony. And I've obeyed Him as far as I know how to obey Him. I will continue to as long as He gives me the strength to travel for Him. All right. Now, living in the convent and going through all of these heavy penances, suffering things that I haven't told you anything, but you know what I wish every one of you could do? You're not so far away. Just to take a trip over to Old Mexico City. Just to go through the cloistered convents there that the government has opened. And if you can go through there, there'll be both Roman Catholic or Christian guides to take you through. And what you heard me say up here, I haven't told you anything. You're going to see so much more than I have told you from this pulpit. You can see it with your own eyes, touch it with your own hands. And then if you don't believe what you see and what you feel or touch, well, I guess you're dead and don't know it, that's all. But there's going to be some horrible, horrible things. Things that I possibly won't touch on maybe at all, maybe won't even get to them. Maybe not even mention them in this testimony. But I'll tell you right now, if you could go over there and see some of the things that I'm talking about, and the biggest one over there is the Desert of Lions. And when you go through that one, you won't want to go through any of the others. I'll assure you that. Nobody would be able to ever give you enough money to get you to go through another one, because you will have seen enough to last you as long as God lets you live in this world. And those convents now are open. They belong to the government. And there are thousands and thousands of people daily going through those convents, sometimes 200 or 300 people at a time. And there will be guides taking you through, and you're permitted to ask any question that you want to ask. It must be answered. And you should go through and take a look at it and hear some of the things. And I'll tell you, you'll know more about convents than you know after you hear this testimony. And I especially would like for you, when you go through, first place you'd be a go through anyway is through their kitchen. It's a very, very large room. But the first thing I want you to observe is the knot holes in the wall. They're about that big around, but there are hundreds of them all the way around the kitchen walls, knot holes. And you never know, the little nuns never know which one of those knot holes a Mother Superior or a priest is looking through. We never know. And people say when we're in the kitchen, because every 6 weeks, the six of us are work for a period of 6 weeks in the kitchen preparing the food for the nuns. And people will say to me, well, my, you're right there in the kitchen where the food is. Why don't you just eat something? Well, you just should be in a convent for a few weeks. You just steal one bite of food and you wish you'd never seen that food. Through one of those knot holes, she saw you get it, or a priest saw you get it. And then you're going to pay a price that you don't know anything about. It's too severe. And so that's the way they guard us. That's the way they watch us. So it's not possible even for you to get a hold of a bite of food, an extra bite of food. So you just go hungry. All right, I'd like for you to see the flagellation whips. Pick up those steel whips, those chains, and just wrap one about around your body about once, and you won't want it. To do it any oftener, I can assure you. But it'll let you know and let you feel and let you know, understand what little nuns are going through. And I think people ask me, and hundreds of people ask me, and I don't know how many asked me last night, are the cloistered convents in the United States? Well, I know of 72 in the United States. Thousands and thousands of little girls right now, and in the middle-aged women and older women, are behind closed convent doors right now here in the United States. And they're going to bed hungry tonight. You're going to bed and you have all the food that possibly much more than you should have to eat. But they are going to bed hungry. When I think about it, I think, oh God, why do these things have to be? All right, then, I wish you'd do more than that. As you look at all of these things, I want you to go on into the what we call the graveyard. There's a graveyard there. Surely they have to have a graveyard. Many, many nuns die, and some of them very, very young. But you'll see a graveyard such as you've never seen in your life. And when you get ready to go through that particular room, the guard will give you a he'll, for instance, there'll be a body of people behind him, following him. And he has yards and yards and yards of rope round around his hand and wrist. Then he'll throw that out clear away out there, maybe 100 yards of it. And then he'll have each of you walk out there and pick that rope up. While you're picking up the rope, he's catching a little trap door over here. And then all of a sudden he'll tell every one of you to get down. First you stand up. Then you go down on your knees. And when I say on your knees, I mean down on your knees. And then you're going to come through this tunnel. You can't walk. You can't raise up. You have to get down on your knees. And you're going to crawl about 3 city blocks. And your knees will be sore by the time you get through there. You're going to crawl through that tunnel right out into a cemetery. And when I say cemetery, not like your cemeteries, not like the ones you and I are talking about and know about. You're going to crawl out in a massive, massive room, larger than anything you've ever seen in this world. And then you'll get up, and you're going to march around like this. And about this close together, you're going to see in the wall nuns, the bodies of little nuns sealed up in stone walls about this thick. There'd be a plain piece of glass about that big a square. That's all you'll see of her little face. Her eyes are closed. She's sealed up in that wall. Walk clear around that mammoth place and look into the faces of all of those precious little girls that have been deceived by the hierarchy of the Roman Catholic Church, promised a throne in heaven if they become the bride of Christ. And there they are, sealed up in those walls. Well, it'll waken you up. It'll make you thank God if you have a little girl. You'll pray harder than you've ever prayed before, if she never gets her life messed up with something like that. It's a serious thing, but it's there for you to see. Then I'd like for you to see the lime pits. You'll have to see them because it's right on the tour. And when you see that mammoth, it's a mammoth as you go walk, you're going to walk around it. But I wouldn't try it to your courage, had you. Maybe I'm not a good judge, don't have good judgment, comes to distance. But it's a mammoth place. Out in the middle of a room like that, and it's deep, and it's lined with cement. But as you come in over here, the crowd does is following the guard. You're going to march around there, and there you're going to look at hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of baby bones, baby skulls. Who do those babies belong to? How did they get there? Ask your guide. You're going through. You ask the guy that's taking you through. He better tell you. Go back and report him if he didn't, and they'll give you another guide. And I tell you, when those guides tell you they belong to the little nuns and the Roman Catholic priests who wear the holy habit, or rather will hide behind the holy habit, many of them, your father confessors, they are the fathers of those babies, but they are put to death. If you could see how they're put to death. You know, years after I was delivered out of the convent, years after I was saved and out on the field, Sister Nyla loves babies. She's always, as soon as service was over, all her service was over, she'd be picking up somebody's baby and loving it, walking around with it. She'd always come up to me and hold it, but I'd put my hands behind me. I didn't want to touch it. I felt like I couldn't touch it. I couldn't stand to touch it. It was years before I put my hand on a baby and to hold one in my arms, never. It took years for me to get over that. Why? Because I saw how those little babies were put to death. And I think the thing that made it even worse for me is I've had to deliver those babies. Many of them, I've had to deliver them. Only to know they're not even bathed. never have a baby blanket around them, just bounced over there on an old board table, and in a few moments there, their little eyes are snuffed out. And if he doesn't do something to you, doesn't burn down deep into your soul, well, there's something wrong with you. You never forget that experience as long as you live. And I can assure you right now, I had to spend a period of time in a dungeon. I walked in under my own strength, but I didn't walk out. Why? Because Mother Superior one day wanted me to put 7 babies to death. I said, Mother Superior, lock me up, take every bit of food away from me, do anything you want to, here I am, kill me, I don't care what you do to me, I'm going to die anyway. But I will not kill those babies. You can't make me. I will not kill those babies. And how I thank God that I didn't kill those precious little infants. Innocent little victims. Born in this world, breathe a few moments and then die. Because of hidden sin. It's been covered up for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And I try to tell you Roman Catholic people about it, and you don't want the truth. Many of you don't want the truth. If somebody paid your way over to Old Mexico and took you to those convents and let you look at these things with your own eyes and touch them with your own hands, you still will hold on to that old Roman doctrine. It will send your soul to hell unless you repent of your sins and lay your all on the altar and make everything right before you die. Now, I'm serious with you folk. Is there more for me to see? Why, I could never stop. If I said that, if I didn't give any testimony at all, I should say there's more for me to tell you. This little nun that gave her life to the faith. I have the Holy Ghost, and members in this building have the baptism of the Holy Ghost. But I wonder now just what you do facing an issue like this. During the Easter period, the Lenten season, one little nun voluntarily, willingly gives her life for the faith. No, she is not made to die. Definitely not. But one little nun gives her life for the faith. Are you willing to give your life for the faith? Oh, you say yes. But I wonder if you met the issue, if you really would. How much God do you have? How close to God are you? I tell you right now, folk, when we're facing the issue, it's a different story altogether. This precious little girl knows, because she has already volunteered. She's away back there at the end of that room. And that little girl knows on this particular occasion that she's going to walk down that same aisle all alone by herself. And there is going to be a priest over here behind a wall over here who is talking to her. But you know what he's saying? I am God. I am God. And he's telling that little nun where to go. And she comes on down like this, and she walks over here, and she's this door right there, and it's open. Then there's a long dark hall, no lights. She's going down that long hall, the first door on the right hand side. As soon as she gets there, she's to stop and hesitate. And as she attempts to step in, which she's supposed to, automatically that piece of machinery picks that little nun up, and her body is pulverized into millions of pieces. And it goes right down through a funnel underneath the convent into the river. And only God knows where those pieces are by this time. And we went there to pray for lost humanity. We gave up our home. We gave up our mothers and dads and everything in the world we loved to go into a convent, supposedly to pray for lost humanity. And this is what we find. Oh, let me tell you, folk, it's serious when you realize these things are going on. Then I'd like for you, this is all I'm going to give you, this particular part of it. I'd like for you, some of you may never go and see them, but some of you, I hope you take your vacation and go see it. You go into this massive room, much larger than this, and over on this side, there'll be 2 rows of tables. Tables about this long, maybe about this long. And they're about this wide, and they stand about this high. And there'll be 1 row here and 1 row there. There's an aisle between them. And all, as you walk down that aisle, be clear to the back. It's a long distance, folks. It's a long ways to walk. But on each of those tables, we call it a casket. You'll see there is a glass casket sitting on that table, about this long and about this wide and about this high. And as you walk that center aisle into each of those glass caskets, you're going to see a human pickled hearts. Ask your guide whose hearts are those. All right, when you come on this side, you walk down that center aisle, and there are caskets, one on either table. And when you ask your guide what this is, who do these belong, what's in those caskets? Human pickled tongues. Oh, listen, folks, talk about Roman Catholicism. I say she's the darkest religion there is in the world today. I say that from the bottom of my heart, sincerely, because I was a part of her corruption the most of my life. I know what she does undercover. Now, we're not talking about the saints that go to your Roman Catholic churches. You don't even know these things exist. You know nothing about them. You're not exposed to those things. You don't even know they exist. So they can't hold you for that. But we that have gone to those places and lived there, we surely know about it. Well, I could take you farther, but I'm not going to. That's enough for you to hear about tonight of that. I'm going to tell you how God delivered me out of the convent. And let me tell you right now, it was a wonderful experience, and how I thank God for deliverance out of a convent. And I wonder if you would feel as I feel when you realize all of these things that went on, and I haven't only touched a few things. But if all of these things had happened to you and you have gone through all of these things, I wonder what you'd feel like if God delivered you out from a place like that. Then one day let you hear the gospel and Savior. Listen, folks, you'd live for God. I never seen the day that I wanted to look back. I didn't leave anything over there I wanted. No, 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 no. I don't want to look back. I want to look ahead, because I expect to spend eternity with my lovely Jesus. And I want to be sure that I'm ready when my name is called. That means I must live holy, consecrated, dedicated unto Him. All right. Living in a place like this, and all of the penances that are placed upon us, and all the horrible things that go on, and seeing the lives of so many little babies snatched out. Folks, you know, because such bitterness gets into my heart, and hatred. I didn't know one heart could hold that much hatred. One heart could hold that much bitterness. I didn't know a human being could hold all of that hatred. Because, and the reason for it is of the terrible things that we've lived through and had to see. The terrible penances they've placed upon our bodies, and the cruelty they have inflicted upon us. And this is supposed to be a religious organization, by the way. And here it is, and you know the reason I went into the convent in the first place. Where I had brought hatred and more hatred that I knew existed in this world. And I'm filled with it. Literally filled. For more than 10 years, I planned premeditated murder. I planned in my heart. I hated. I saw three Mother Superiors die in my period of time in the convent. But I planned after they died. They died somewhat in maybe normal deaths, but not one of them. One of them didn't. She was killed, but the other two did. But anyway, I planned to kill this woman. I hated her. Oh, how many little lives she snuffed out. If that woman doesn't repent of her sins and come clean before God, she has a legion of devils in her. She will spend eternity in hell, and if there is a hotter place, that's where she'll be. No, no, that holy habit that she hides behind will never save her. Those rosary beads will never save her. That scapular will never save her. No, none of these things will ever save her. She'll be lost forever, but that'll be too late unless she repents and cleans up while there's yet time for her. But, so through the hatred and the bitterness, you began to premeditate and plan murder. And I'm hungry. You're so nearly starved to death all the time. It's a hunger. And after you've gone so long, my body had wasted away until I was only 89 pounds. And that's, for me, a large frame like I have. That's very, very small. There was no flam and meat on my body, just skin or bone. But anyway, as I continued to hate and continued to build up in my heart, I began to plan, how am I ever going to get this Mother's Day? I just want to catch her in a certain spot. I'll catch her where I'm alone. And many, many times have I stolen a meat cleave and carried it under my holy habit. Many a time I've carried a knife under my holy habit, waiting for an opportune time when I could kill that woman, because I was full of murder. I meant to kill her. All the love had gone out of my heart. I didn't believe there was any God. I didn't have any God. I didn't take God in the convent with me. I didn't find him in the convent. And I'll assure you, I didn't bring him out with me, because he isn't there. God could not live in a convent. That would be impossible. There's too much crime and too much sin there. But anyway, time went on, time went on. And one day the mother appeared. Now, she was not well. She was a much older woman, getting older. She has a beautiful bedroom sitting room. And you know, she sleeps on a lovely bed just like you and I do now. And she eats the best food that money can buy. She and the priests are usually there. And they eat the very best of food. They have the best of everything. That's why, and people say to me, why do you always say little nuns? I couldn't say anything else because I never saw a fat nun. After we're there for a year, we all become so skinny and thin it's pitiful, because we're half starved to death. But the mother superiors are always very much overweight. I was going to kill that woman, and what opportunity would I have? And so, you know, you think the time will never come. Days are long there, nights are long, and you feel like the time's never going to come. Well, one day it did come. First of all, I was punished so severely, and this was a terrible punishment. I was so hungry. Now, I'm not a thief. I wasn't a thief before I went in the convent. Now, I surely wasn't one when I went in the convent, after I lived in there. But anyway, one day, because I was so very, very hungry, and I did it because I was hungry, wouldn't think of doing it for any other reason, six little nuns are put in the kitchen. Now, kitchen is up on the first floor in these cloistered convents. And ever so often, six little nuns are placed in the kitchen. We do all the kitchen work and preparing the food for the little nuns. And I was in the kitchen working at this particular period of time and preparing the vegetables for the soup and getting food ready for the little nuns. And you know, there we never allow us to peel a potato. We always boil them and slip the skin off. Remember, we have taken the oath of crucial poverty, and we live in crucial poverty. And if you peel the potato, well, you waste some of it. And so naturally, we had boiled them and take the skin off of them. And I remember this particular day. Oh, I wanted out of that convent so much. Oh, Mama, how I prayed. Was that Aunt Sarah that you heard me tell about, that little old lady that lived down the road from my dad, had told me, Charlotte, if you go in the convent, I'll pray for you every day as long as God lets her live, that God will deliver me out of the convent, and I'll hear the gospel and be saved. And you'll hear about her later. Well, anyway, so naturally, here I am. That evening when just one can go to the garbage can, when we put it all together, we must all march out of the kitchen together. Now, our kitchen is quite a long room. It's as long as this crust, and about the fourth row back, it's about that big of a room. And over here, there are three steps leading down right there. And then there is a foundation, or a landing, we'll call it. Over here, there's a big, heavy door. It has double locks on it. And for right here is where the garbage can sits. And from there on down, there are cement steps leading one story down into the lower basement. All right, that's where we put our garbage, in those garbage cans. And this night was a night that I put the garbage in the can. And you know, as I got it all together, but thought is going through my mind. I'm hungry. I'm just more hungry than you could imagine. And so I thought, well, if I could just take those potato skins and keep them on top where they didn't get messed up with everything else, well, maybe I could just steal a few of them, if it's called stealing. And so I carried them down, and I put everything in that garbage can and watched the potato skins, because I tried to keep them over on the side. And you know, after I did, I reached in and got two hands full, one in either hand. Put them down. We have deep pockets on our skirts. I have three skirts on. The top skirt has a pocket on either side. So I put a handful of those potato skins in each of my pockets on either side of my dress. And I smooth them out real flat, of course, and careful. And then I come on up where the other little nuns are, then the work is all done out in the kitchen, and we have to march out. But as we go by the Mother Superior back there, she goes right down the side of your skirts like that to see if there's any food. She's going to be sure you haven't taken any food out of that kitchen. And that's why I smoothed those potato skins out flat as I could. Well, she didn't find them anyway. But you know, I waited. I didn't eat them there. You wouldn't dare. There's five little nuns out there. You have any friends in the convent? You don't trust anybody in the convent. You have no confidence in any human being in the world. And so there, those little nuns. Then after we little nuns had gone on by, you know, I got so far. Before I left, though, I almost forgot to tell you. When I put the garbage down here, I thought, now how am I going to get back in that kitchen? Because you don't run around in the convent like the most people think you are. When you leave the convent, the six of us, we never get back in that convent till the next morning. And I know that. All right, I had to have an excuse to get back in that convent. And this is what I done. And I hardly had the strength to do it. It took me a long time. I wanted to take the large crucifix, the one to wear around the waistline. I took it off. And I put my foot on it, this chain, and I tugged, I pulled, I did everything. And I didn't have too much strength until I broke that chain. I had to have a reason. Then I took it in here, and over there's a long shelf here over our work table. I laid it upon that shelf, and then we all walk out of the room together. And when I got so far back there, close enough to the Mother Superior, I'd be the next one she'll speak to. I said, "Oh, Mother Superior, I broke my crucifix and it's out in the kitchen. May I go and get it?" And we're never supposed to be without our crucifix. And she said, "How did you break it?" And I lied to her. And oh, she asked me so many questions and I lied to her about everything. All right, in a few moments she said, "You go out to the kitchen and get the crucifix and you come right back." Well, what do you think I broke the crucifix for? When she told me that, I went. But folk, I didn't go anywhere near that crucifix. I'll tell you what I did. I went right down here to this garbage can. Why did I do that? Well, I'll tell you. In the period of the 6 weeks we lived in that kitchen and did the cooking and everything, there's a chain up here on the wall and a pencil's tied on it. And when we work in the kitchen, if we run out of anything while we're working out there, we have to write it on that tab of paper. And the Mother Superior orders everything that comes into the convent. And we don't know where it comes from. We just know she orders it. All right? I had tore off a little piece of paper about that big around off of a dirty sack that one day before I put some garbage in the can. I wadded up in a little wad and then finally smoothed that out. And I had that hidden again. Corner of my pocket for days and days. And every time I could get a hold of that pencil, I'm going to put a word on this little note. I'd try to smooth out the edge of it. Those little nuns were not watching me too closely. I'm scared to death of them because they'd tell the Mother Superior. And God knows where I would have been put away or what she would have done to me. And so you know what I did? It took me, I only got 2.5 lines on it in those 6 weeks. Is all I got on that piece of paper. And so when I put all the garbage in there and had that 2 handfuls of potato skins in my pocket, I tell you, we're supposed to put the lid on the garbage can. It's full. And I know that day the garbage man, I don't know who he is. I've never seen him. And I didn't know just how the garbage got out of there. I learned later, but I didn't know then. And so we're supposed to put the lid on. Well, I stretched out that little piece of paper real smooth, laid it right on top, but I didn't put the lid on. And this is what I said to the garbage man. "Please, won't you help me?" I said, "Won't you leave that big iron gate unlocked and that kitchen door?" And I said, "There are 19 little nuns, 2 stories under the ground, chained in cells. Won't you please help me?" That's all I had time to say. All right. You go back to it, it makes you sick when you even think about it. Something to think about, because those are experiences you'd like to forget. You wish you could put them out of your mind forever, never had to bring them back again to your mind. But anyway, when I come out supposedly to get my crucifix, I run to the can. I tipped it. And when I tip that can, there's a piece of paper laying on the floor. And you know, I don't have a palsy. I never did have a palsy. But when I picked that piece of paper up, I began jumping all over my body, and my hands were just going it. And I couldn't stop them. So I can't see what's on that little piece of paper. It wasn't very legible anyway. And I was shaking all over, and I can't see. And of course, I'm scared to death because we have a buzzer. And when a little nun dares to escape from the convent, that buzzer goes on. We should be around about that time and see the priests are coming from everywhere. People say they don't go in the convents. So that's all you know about it. But oh, let me tell you, folk, I was scared. And I wanted to get things over as quick as I could. And so I tried to hold myself as steady as I can so I can read what's on that piece of paper. I don't know how long it took, but when I read the words, it said, I'm leaving that door open, unlocked. I'm leaving the big iron gate unlocked. Come on out. I didn't believe a word of it. I didn't believe that. Those things don't happen to nuns. But anyway, that's exactly what it said. Now, I was frightened, and you know, I walked over to that door. And when I turned the knob and that door actually opened, I've never been that frightened in my life. There's a cement stoop out there, and there's three steps stepping down into a lovely big patio out there. And way off down here in the corner is a big iron gate. But anyway, as I opened that door, and I just put one foot out, and fear grabbed me. Because I remember those 19 little nuns down there. I'll tell you about them in a few moments. All right, that fear grabbed me until I put my foot in quickly and shut the door. Then I happened to think, oh, I wonder if Mother and Dad are alive. Wonder if my people are living. I wonder if there would ever be a chance for me to get back into my country. I could find my people again. I would love to see my mother and father, naturally. And so I thought, well, if I don't go now, I'll never have another opportunity. So I opened the door, and I stepped out quickly before I changed my mind, and I tripped the lock on both of those locks. And then I stepped down off those two steps, and I made a run for that iron gate. And when I got down to that iron gate, it's locked just as tight as it was ever locked. And oh, talk about scared. I was scared. Here I am out in the yard, have no right to be out there, no business to be out there. And I know how serious it is. And what am I going to do? How am I going to get back in? Oh, listen, folk, you don't know half of it. And I thought, what'll I do? I just stood and looked at that big iron gate. And of course, my body didn't look like this. Just 89 pounds, and I was certainly not well. But you know, I'm barefooted. And I looked at that gate, and finally the thought said, well, just try. And I went over there and grabbed a hold of those iron bars. Because I'm barefooted, it was just a little easier to climb. But I believe with all of my heart, mind, and soul that God gave me supernatural strength that I didn't even know about. Oh, yes, I do. And so I was climbing that gate. And about a foot and a half from the top, there's a ledge about this wide going clear across the top of the gate. And from that ledge on up this high, there are sharp points, iron points, clear across. Now, you know how much clothes a nun wears? Three heavy skirts. And my heavy veil to come clear down here in the front and clear down here in the back. How in this world am I going to get all of these clothes over that gate? I got up high enough that I got one knee on the ledge. And then I'm shaking like I had a palsy. I'm half scared to death, of course. And I'm no breath. I was out of wind. And so I held there for a little while. And then I thought, well, if I could get the other foot over. Well, how am I going to get the other foot over all of these clothes? See, those skirts, you know, they're heavy material. And clear down to my ankles. And so I just happened to think. Well, I reached down. I was holding onto the gate with this hand. I reached down to the other hand and got a hold of the bottom of my skirt. And I just pulled them right up around me like that. And then I got the other foot over on the ledge on the other side. And then you look down. And when you was, and their body was in condition mine was in, you just think about making that jump. I was hardly breathing. I was so tired. I was thought I was going to die right there. And of course, I'm afraid the buzzer's going on. And let me tell you, folk, I was afraid if I jump, I'll break every bone in my body. But fine, in a few moments, I thought of that buzzer. Then I thought of Mom and Dad again. And all right, I'm going to jump regardless. And I made the jump, but I wanted to jump far enough that it would clear the gate naturally. And I jumped as far as I could, and because I didn't have strength. And two of my skirts caught on those sharp points. And there I had let loose of the gate. And you can imagine what I felt like. I'm hanging there on the top of that gate. Oh, listen. I didn't know I had gray hair when I came out of the convent. I didn't know that my eyes were sunken back in my head. My eyes were back in my head. I didn't know I looked like that, because I never knew my age. We have no birthdays. You don't know what you look like. We don't have any mirrors in the convent. You're not going anywhere. You don't have any hair to comb. The clippers are put on your head every 3 months. You're bald-headed. And so you don't know any of that. Well, maybe that's where my hair turned gray as I hung there. And I thought, how am I going to get down? That buzz will go on. Well, I think I went through 10 hells in just that few minutes. And then a thought came to my mind. I didn't have a hold of the gate at all because my hands were in front of me. So I just began to try to swing my body like this. And I just kept doing it until I could get force enough to get that hand back far enough to grab that gate. And when I got a hold of that gate with this hand, let me tell you, I held on to it for a little while. And then I thought, now what am I going to do? If I jump, I still am going to be hurt. So with this hand, I reach back, and our skirts are all on a belt, and there's a snapper in the back. I reach back, and I try to pry the snappers loose on my skirt. And let me tell you, I got two of them loose. And when I did, I fell between those skirts. When I hit the ground, that's where I broke my shoulder and broke my arm just above the elbow. I don't know how long I lay there, how long I was out. I can't tell you because I don't know. And actually, I don't even know where I am. I know the country I'm in, but that's all I do know. When I came to, I looked around and don't think I waited for somebody to come and pick me up, because I didn't. I got up and started moving as fast as I could. Where? I don't know where I am, I couldn't tell you where I'm going. I just want to get away from there as fast as I can, as far as I can, and as quick as I can. All right, so I'd run a little bit, then I'd walk a little fast. And it was really terrible. And I tell you right now, I was out for 3 days and 3 nights, no food. No water, scared to death to rap on the door and ask for a drink of water, to ask anybody for food. And then, you know, this one particular day, I just felt like I couldn't stand it. I was going to die. I really thought I was going to die. And I'd walked over such terrible ground and rocks and things, my feet. See, I'm barefooted, and my feet were in such a condition. They were so much pain connected with it. I got over under the fence in the field, and there's a big old straw stack over there. And I saw it, and I went over there where the animals had sort of burrowed in there to lay down. I went in the same place, and I laid in there. From the way the sun looked, it could have been about noon. But anyway, I crawled back in there, and I laid in there most of the afternoon. Then I realized, I can't stay here. I'm too close to the convent. I'll be found. And so I got out of there, and I started walking. And I wanted not to be out when it's dark, because I was afraid. See, I am a woman, after all. And I haven't been out in the world for so many years, 22 long years. I'm scared to death of everything. And so I got out, and I started walking. And I walked quite a ways. And then it was coming just dusk, and I saw this little old home. It was very poor looking. And I went up to the door. It was either that or die, one or the other. And so I walked up to that door, and the inside door was open, the screen was closed. And I rapped on the door, and a tall man come to the door. And all I said to him was, "Sir, please, may I have a drink of water?" And he didn't answer me. He just turned around and went back in the house, and I heard him call his wife. And when she come to the door, thank God, there are some wonderful people in this world. You know that little woman, what she did? She didn't say, "Who are you? Where'd you come from?" And I was carrying this hand and this hand. And that woman, naturally, when she come to the door, she just pushed that screen door open and invited me in. Oh, folks, talk about music. That's the most beautiful music I ever heard. And there was a table right over there, a round table with a red checkered tablecloth on. She invited me over there and pulled a chair out and invited me to sit down. And I'm shaking like a leaf. I'm sick. I'm hurt. Nobody knows the condition you were in. And as I sat there, that man, he went out of the house or out of the room, but she never said a word, and I saw her walk over here and go through a door. A few moments she come back, and there was a little old stove over there, just a little old iron stove. She had something in a pan, she set it on that stove. But it's when I saw her pour it in a glass that I knew it was milk. And so she brought that over. Now I knew if I took that milk, I'd be very sick. We don't get milk in the convent. But you know, I was so starving that I just grabbed it like a wild person and gulped it down naturally. And her husband walked over there by the table. And after I got the milk down, he said to me, "Now, would you tell us where did you come from? How did you get hurt like this?" And on he asked question, and I said, "Well, I escaped from a convent. And, of course, I have a Carmelite nun's habit on." And they knew there's a convent, and possibly a mile, maybe 3 miles from there. They know that. And they knew possibly that's the one I escaped from. And I said, "How did you get your shoulder and arm broken?" And when they looked at that hand and arm was swollen as tight as it could swell, because I was carrying it, the pain was terrific. And that man talked to me, and he said, "Now, remember, we are your friends. We're not going to harm you, but I'm going to have to go and get a doctor." And he started toward the door, and let me tell you, I got off of that chair like a flash, and I was at the door before he was. Now I was going to grab the hold of him. "Oh, no, 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 no. If you call a doctor out here, they'll take me right back to the convent." And you know, that man had to just set me down and talk to me and reason with me. And he and his wife, and tried to assure me that they were not going to hurt me, not going to harm me, that I wouldn't be going back to the convent. They have to have help. And so they're getting a doctor for me. He didn't have any car. They're poor people. And he hitched up a horse and buggy and drove 10 miles to get that doctor. Doctor came out in his car. And when that doctor come in there and walked around that chair where I was sitting and saw me, I've never heard any worse swearing. I mean, he swore. And he said so much. And it was terrible. What in the world have they done to you? What have they done to you? And who has done this terrible thing? And so he said, "I have to take you into the hospital." Well, of course, I was just, I was hysterical. It was terrible. But he was very nice to me. And so he took me out and put me in the car, and they took me to the hospital. I told you about that the first night. And, of course, it took me a long time to get acquainted there and to build confidence. And I was in that convent or in that hospital for possibly over 2 years, as far back as I can figure it up. But you know, that dear little old couple, they would hitch up that horse and buggy and drive to that convent about every other day. And she'd pick some wild flowers, bring them in the convent, and put them in a glass and set them there on the dresser in my room. Oh, folk, to think somebody cared. Somebody loved me enough to bring me a flower. Maybe you don't know what it feels like when you're not loved. You have nobody. Nobody cares. Maybe you don't know what that feels like. But I do. And that little woman and man did that. Several months they done that. And they just kept bringing me flowers. They would have brought me food and things, but I didn't dare eat, of course. It took so long, 4 months before I could eat any normal food at all. But when I could, even in their poverty, they would bring me something that I could eat. And oh, I learned to love them like my own mother and daddy. I really treasured them. I was so grateful. And I loved them. All right, I'm getting much stronger. And the doctor, finally the day came. After I'd been in there, I don't know if it was 8 or 9 months or 10 months or near a year, whatever it might have been. You don't remember the dates, and I don't even try to tell you that. But I was in there until they had built confidence in me, and I built confidence in them. But nobody knew my name yet. And so this day the doctor come in and sit right down beside my bed, and he pulled a chair up, took my hands in his hands. And of course, I told you they knew I was not from that country. My speech betrayed me. But he looked at me and he said, "Now, girlie, we've done everything that we know to do for you physically. We have helped you in every way that we know how to get you well. But you can't go, of course, now. But if you'll tell me what your name is, you'll tell me what country you're from, if you'll give me the name of your father and mother and their address, I will contact your people. And when you're well enough, we'll see that you get back into your country and you'll be with your folks." Why, I cried that like to never got me stopped. I cried till I was sick. I didn't believe him, but I wanted to believe him. But oh, nobody knows how it feels like. And so I stayed on in the hospital because I had to. But that dear little old couple were just still so good to me, and I still loved them. And the day come then, all the nurses were grand to me, and so on and so forth. And people gave me things and brought me things later on in the hospital. And some gave me money, and so on and so forth. But you know, one day when they were going to release me from the hospital, the doctor was going to take me out to his suburban home. He and his wife were about 45 years of age, and they never had any children. They had a lovely suburban home. They were going to take me out there and keep me until I was strong enough for them to get me back in the United States. Now they had already found that my mother and father are both alive. Only my mother was paralyzed every inch of her body. She was horribly paralyzed, couldn't move any portion of her body, but she was alive. He already had this much word from my family. And when he told me about it, you can imagine how I felt. And oh, every day you'd count the days and the moments. I wanted to go so badly. And so when I was going to be released from the hospital, he was going to take me out to his home the following morning. Very early, that little old couple were at the hospital. And you know, they had a bouquet of flowers for me. God loved their hearts. They came real early. They wanted to see me, of course, and was afraid I'd go without them seeing me. And when they come in and sit down in my room, they began to talk to me. And that little woman said, "Wouldn't you like to come out to our house and stay a little while with us? We would love to have you." And I mean, they were poor people, very poor people. And I started to cry, and I said, "Oh, I'd love to come out and stay with you." But I said, "Listen, you know how good this doctor has been to me. You know the operation he's performed on me. You know of all of the hospital care that he's given me. And I don't know that I'll ever get well and be able to work and be able to pay back this doctor bill. I don't know that my people will ever do anything about it." And I said, "I wouldn't do anything to hurt this doctor and his wife and those nurses for anything in the world. And so I don't know." Well, just about that time the doctor walked in, and he didn't want to ever see me crying, naturally. They're trying to get me well. And he said, "What in the world is wrong?" And that little woman spoke up real quick, and she said, "Well, I just asked her if she would like to go home with us and spend a little while." And he looked at me right quickly, read my face, of course, and he said, "Would you like to go out there and stay with these old people for a few days?" I was close to the hospital, and the doctor would bring out my medical supplies and so on and so forth. I said, "Well, I would just love to, doctor, but I wouldn't hurt your feelings for anything. You folk have done so much for me." Well, he said, "It's perfectly all right. I'll come and get you. You just go stay a few days with them. They've been so good to you, and they love you." And you know, he bought a big basket of fresh fruit and vegetables and things that I could eat now, because they didn't have the money to buy them. And they bought all the natural things that I'd have to have, my clothes and everything. And so the old couple, the doctor took me out there. All right, I stayed out there with them several months until I was strong enough to go out and gather the eggs. And maybe you think that wasn't a privilege to go out and gather the eggs. Oh, I was the happiest person in the world to think I can go out there and gather eggs. And I was so happy. And then they let me do the dusting. Finally, they let me wash the dishes and dry them. Finally, she let me help a little bit with the cooking. And oh, of course, it thrilled my soul through and through, because I haven't had anything like this with home life. Well, then one day a letter came to these people. It was for me, but their address to them. When they opened it, it was a check in that letter, and it was from this doctor, and he told them to take that check and to go shopping for me and to buy me another pair of shoes and some other clothes and to buy me a suitcase, because I didn't have anything. I come out of the convent a pauper without one penny. I didn't even own the clothing I had on my body. The habit belonged to the convent. And so these people took me shopping. You should have been on that shopping trip. It's one I'll never forget, I'll assure you. But anyway, they took me, and they bought me some clothes, and they bought me some shoes and the things that I had to have. And we come home, and we got everything packed and all ready. And the money that had been given to me that they knew about, because I gave them everything, I didn't know enough to take care of it or look after it or what to do with it even. And so they kept it for me. Finally, they had it transferred over so I could bring it back to the United States with me. And then the doctor came. And when he got there, my folks, I was glad to see him. I thought he had forgotten about me, see. But he came, and when he got there, I was so happy to see him. And that very morning, he put me in the car, and he started out with me. And, of course, how he got my passport, my visa, I don't know a thing about it. I can't tell you because I don't know. But he got it just the same. And everything was all ready. And first they put me on a train. And he treated me like I was 5 years old. He told me, now he said, mostly all the loose money that belonged to me was sewed up in my clothing that I had on. And just a little bit in a purse that they had bought for me. All right, he said, now if you go to sleep, remember, always lay it underneath you. And don't take a bite of food from anybody. Don't take a piece of gum, a bite of candy. Don't even eat a bite of anything except the one individual. And, of course, I knew who that was. I was in charge of, and they were going through with me and take care of me. All right, and I was very obedient. I knew I had sense enough to do that. Anyway, I got off of the train, and we got on the boat. It was on the water for 3 weeks. No, I got so seasick, it was terrible. But I could take food, anything they gave me. I'm put in charge of somebody, but from nobody else. And when we got across the waters into the United States, I remember when they took me from there to the train and put me on the train and put me in charge of the conductor on that train. Oh, I'm in the United States. I'm in my own country at least. And let me tell you right now, that man was good to me. I have so many silver dollars that he gave me. And you know, he would come through many times and bring me an extra sandwich and hand it to me. I had plenty of food because they gave me plenty to eat there on the train. But he just did all those little special things for me. He knew about me, of course. All right, Roa, 3 days and a half we were on the train. And the closer the train we got to my home, I realized the country. I was old, like 3 months, being 13 years old when I left the United States, or rather when I left Mother and Dad. And so I knew something about the country. And so I know I'm getting close home. I knew the name of the towns. And I tell you, I was so excited, and the conductor came through the coach, and he said, now, don't you get up. I'll come in and get your suitcase and carry it out for you. You sit right there, and I'll come and get it. Well, he walked through the coach, and he walked back, and I knew from the town they just called before, I'm only a few miles from home, and I couldn't stand it. As soon as he got up and walked down that aisle, I got up and picked up my suitcase, and I walked right along behind him down that aisle. Now, no, he didn't scold me. He wasn't ugly to me. He wasn't unkind. Of course not. And he, you know, just a few moments, the train pulled into a place where it stopped, and called all aboard. All right, as it stopped, that man had two silver dollars for me and a sandwich. And, you know, he helped me down the steps. He had my suitcase. He set it down. And then he stepped back upon the step. Well, that made me turn around like that and look up at him because he's talking to me. And he said, are you sure you know where your father and mother lives? I said, oh, yes, I know exactly where they live. Because it's just a little bitty rural community, only 250 people, country. And he said, well, be sure. And I said, I am. And I know exactly. And so they called all aboard, and the train pulled out. And when it pulled out, I turned around this way then. And folk, there was a new depot. I never saw that one before. It was a little one, but it was new. And I was so confused then. I'm turned around. I don't know which direction to go. So I just started out. And I decided I better go in there and ask somebody. So I walked in that little depot, and there was a man in there. And I said, do you know my father? And I gave him Dad's name. He said, I've known him 45 years. And he said, what's your name? Well, I didn't tell him my name, but I said, I'm his daughter, one of the older girls. Oh, he said, you're one of the older girls. And that's all he said. He said, come and go with me. And he led me outside, and 5 blocks straight down the street on the corner, on the right-hand side is my home. I tell you right now, I picked up my suitcase and I start walking. I'd only gone a few blocks, and I became so frightened. Why? Because I looked on that corner, and there was no two-story frame house. That's what Dad had when I left home. There's a beautiful brick home sitting on that corner. And it frightened me. And I see I'm sick and I'm very weary. And I thought, oh, my, maybe I'm mistaken. So I thought, well, I'll just go up and knock on the door. I went up to the door and they had a knocker on there. And I used it when I did a man come to the door. And he was very old. He had no hair left, just a little bit around here, edge of his hair. And he was bald-headed and stooped, very stooped in his shoulders. And, of course, immediately I said to him, "Could you tell me where Mr. So-and-so lives?" And when I said that name, immediately that man said, "And what's your name?" Well, I didn't give him my church name. I gave him my own name. And when I did, that man grabbed me and he said, "Hooky, that's my baby name, my pet name at home, what they call me when I was a tiny child. Hooky, Hooky, is this you?" He recognized me then. Then, of course, I started to cry and I said, "Dad, is this Dad?" Why, my father had a head full of real black curly hair and he was a big man. And yet, you know, here he is. He wasn't my dad, didn't look like him at all. But, oh, he pushed the door open and invited me in. And I said, "Dad, is Mother alive?" And he evaded me. And I knew something was wrong. And I wanted to know about her quickly, but he evaded me. In other words, he wanted to know, how did I get out of the foreign country in the United States? And he asked me, and I told him. And then he asked me so many questions, and I had to answer those questions as much as I could, and I did. Finally, then I said, "Dad, is my mother still living?" And he said, "I'll take you to your mother." And so he took me back over here and brought me down a hall like that. The first door over here is her bedroom. And when they took me there, and so there she was lying on the bed, 69 pounds. They'd cut all of her. She had a gorgeous head of natural curly hair. She used to dress in a big figure eight up on the top of her head. I thought she was the most beautiful woman in the world as a child. And there they have cut all that pretty hair off because she's paralyzed. She could only move her eyes. And, you know, she didn't look like my mother to me. And I just couldn't accept it. It was terrible. And so I sat down on a chair by the bed, and I was watching her. And all she could do was to look at me. And I didn't really know her, and she surely didn't know me. And Dad went out of the room. And then finally I turned sick, and I called him and said, "Dad, can I lie down somewhere?" And he come in. He said, brought me down the hall here. And "Hooky, this is your bedroom. As long as you're home, this is your bedroom." And so I went in that bedroom and it didn't undress. I just laid across the bed, went to sleep very quickly. I'm very tired and I'm sick. And you know, about 2:30 in the morning, I wakened up with a severe pain in my stomach. And I called my father, and Dad come immediately. And when he did, he saw I was suffering, so he called the doctor. And the doctor come to our home. He naturally thought it was Mother, so he started to her room. Dad said, "Oh, no, it's not my wife. It's someone you know back here." He brought the doctor back to the bedroom. And there was a nurse in the room. "All right," so the doctor walked in the room. Dad said, "Do you know her?" He said, "Why, no, I don't know. Who is it?" "All right," so the doctor had him to turn me over. I was lying on my stomach, or on my back. The doctor said to the nurse, "Turn her over," and they did. "Who is this doctor?" "This doctor delivered me in this world as a baby. This doctor has known me all of my life. This doctor knows that I was born with a certain mark on my back. Knows all about it. And when he had the nurse to turn me over, and that mark is there, it'll always be there, of course. He immediately accepted me as Hooky. And when he did, of course, he began to cry. He broke down. And he just looked at me and he said to my father, "I'll have to take her to the hospital." Well, of course, Dad began and he broke down. And they took me to the hospital that very night. And I lay 3.5 months in that hospital. And all my father was good to me and all my family were good to me. They did everything for me. And that dear old couple over in the foreign country, they reimbursed them with money. And as long as they lived, they sent barrels of fruit over to that country that doesn't grow there to that old couple. And they paid my doctor bill over there. And only God knows how many thousands of dollars it is. But my father was a wealthy man. All right, now here I am in this hospital. Don't worry, there's going to be plenty. I was there 3.5 months. And I couldn't walk. They operated a second time on my hip. And I couldn't walk, so they brought me home in the ambulance. And when they carried me in, Dad had a big reclining chair sitting right in the edge of the bed, or living room. And they kind of brought me in. They set me down in that big reclining chair. And then after everybody got away, sort of away from right there, and settled down, my father come over to me. And he said, "Now, Hooky, right behind you is the library." And he said, "Now, when we bring you out here and sit you down in this chair, He knows we're all, my people are readers. We love to read. And he said, now you just tell us anything you want, any book you want, we'll bring you the book. Because you know you love to read. Because you're going to just eat, sleep, rest, and get well now. And Dad was talking to me. No, it made me so happy, you don't know how I felt. And on, they were so very good to me. But I sensed something from my sisters. I mean, I really felt something very sharp. Why, one day, they had just brought me out, and only a few moments, I was sitting in that chair, and company drove up in front of the home. And, of course, I didn't know who they were or anything, and I didn't even see the car drive up from where they had me sitting. But my sisters just walked over there quickly and got me up and rushed me back to my bedroom. And they shut the door. Why did they do that? Because they were ashamed of me. After all, I spent my life in the convent, and all of my sisters and brothers are college graduates. And I gave my life to a convent hoping that I was going there to win souls for God. And they went to school and were all highly educated. And they didn't want those neighbors or friends to see me because I looked awful, terrible. And I didn't have any hair. It was just little stubble all over my head. And they were ashamed of me. And all the tears I shed, only God will ever know. I suffered so terribly from it. Well, you know, I didn't seem to get better. I was there in the home for several weeks, and I kept getting worse all the time.
Understand, maybe they never heard, but it is my personal testimony. Anything that I say tonight will be things that I've lived through, have the experience. It's been a part of my life, as I spent 24 years and 8 months behind convent doors. And so tonight, I realize many of you, some of the younger ones already have said to me, goodness, are you going to take us out from under that rug tonight? Well, surely I'm going to take you out from under that rug, but let me tell you something, folks. You're under that rug only in your imagination. I was under that rug in reality. You'll never know what an experience, what a feeling it was to be under that rug. Half scared to death, knowing that I'm in the hands of my enemy, knowing that I just have no idea what they're going to do with me, where they're going to take me. No, I didn't know a thing about it. And half scared to death, you can be assured of that. Well, it was a terrible, terrible thing. As we leave the eyes, they left me under the rug. But we traveled that day. We traveled all day. You say, why did they put you under the rug? Well, when I was picked up, walking those several blocks with my former uncle going on an errand, when I was picked up, naturally, as they put me in the car, made me get between the front and the back seat and then to lie down on the floor. I didn't know where we were going. I didn't know what they were going to do. But when the car started rolling away, I sat up. And when I did, they pushed me back down on the floor, and I sat up the third time, they pushed me back. And the next time I tried to sit up, they put the foot on me, so I had to. There were four men. I told you about them last night. And they were four men, big strapping fellows, dressed in civilian clothing. And they were four Roman Catholic priests, dressed in civilian clothing. You say, how do you know, Sister Charlotte? When I took my white veil, when I entered a convent as a child, took my white veil at 16 and a half years of age, my black veil at 21 years of age, it did not come out in the papers. It was never, never printed. The public did not know what our Christian name would be. My own family did not know what my Christian name was going to be. And when one of those priests, when I turned around on the sidewalk and looked into their faces, because they were following me and I knew that, and when one of those priests called me by my church name, then it made me to know I am in the hands of my enemy. And I was frightened sick. And so when they put me in the car and kept shoving me down on the floor and finally put their foot on me and held me down, oh, I begged for mercy. I asked them, where are you taking me? What are you going to do with me? What have I done? I didn't know of anything I'd ever done other than escape from a convent in a foreign country, which you've already heard about. But they kept trying to put the pressure on me. And I knew I hadn't done anything. But anyway, as we rode all day long, in the evening time, they drove up in the suburbs of a large city. And there they stopped the car down on the street. And when they stopped that car, two of the priests in front got out of the car. And the two in the back said, one of them said to me, "You can sit up." Well, folks, I was so glad to sit up because I felt like my back was broken. There's a hump on it back there. You lay that many hours like I did, and oh my, it was painful. But anyway, when I did sit up on the floor and I looked out of the car window, I wish I could have had a heart attack and died right then. I wasn't a Christian. I didn't realize the seriousness of it. Because I'm looking right over the top of a convent. Now, why did they pull up in front of that convent down here on the street? I thought they was going to take me in the convent, of course, or they wouldn't have stopped there. But you know, when we got out of the car, one priest on either side and the two behind me, they led me right up in front of the convent. It's back from the sidewalk quite a ways, and a white fence around there, and a lovely big yard. And the building is massive, very massive, large building. And I thought they were going to take me in there, surely, but they didn't. They just turned and took me on down the sidewalk. And we walked blocks and blocks and blocks down that sidewalk. And now I'm really wondering where they're taking me and what they're going to do. And you're half scared to death, of course, because you realize what it's all about. And you know, in a little while, they directed my path this way, and they kept walking me this way up a sidewalk. And then I observed, now, in the convent, we, all the years I've lived there, we have walked around with our eyes about half open, downcast, in other words. We were never free to open our eyes and look out. God had to deliver me after I got back in the United States and heard the gospel. After God saved me, God had to deliver me that I could look out into a congregation. Because my eyes, I just couldn't do it. It was seemingly impossible. And so, you know, I'm walking here with my eyes about half shut. And as we go, but I observe those steps. And the one on either side of me walked me up some steps. And there was a long porch across the front of this big home. And as we got up on the very top step, I observed over to my right, just the glimpse of a big church. And I knew it was a Roman Catholic church, of course. All right, I saw it. I wondered, now where are they going to take me? Well, one of the priests stepped over to the door. And he didn't knock on the door. He didn't ring a bell. He didn't unlock the door. He just opened it and walked in, pushed me in ahead of him. And we started walking down the hall, and on one side over here was a stairway going upstairs. No wonder, this side was a solid wall. And they walked me right onto the dining room and the kitchen. And we got over in that corner of the kitchen. They opened the door, and then they had me to walk in the, through that door. And that ladder was a stairway leading to the basement. And they took me down to the basement, and we crossed the basement way over like this in that corner. And when we got over there in that corner, immediately the priests were all of them with me, all four of them, the two holding on to me. We got over in that corner. They opened another door. And when we did this, I realized now what it's all about. They're taking me right back to that convent. But why did they park the car down here on the street and then walk that many blocks away down the street? Why didn't they just walk up the front steps and take me in the convent? They do everything undercover. Everything undercover. And so when they opened that door, then I'm walking right into a tunnel. And we walked through that long, long tunnel back to that convent. And when we got back there, one of the priests, I said, we take two of the best detectives in the United States who have found the secret button. So one of those priests walked over on my right. And what he touched, I don't know. I couldn't tell you that. But he touched, anyway, a secret button, and sliding doors just slid back very quickly, and there stood the Mother Superior of that convent. Now, I've never seen that convent before. I've never been in it. I know nothing about it whatsoever. But the mother said, they said, she's here. The mother said, bring her on in. So they brought me on in. All right, now I'm in that convent, and I'm there to spend God only knows possibly the balance of my life, because I didn't ever expect to get out again. I was older, and I didn't think I'd ever possibly ever get out of the convent again. But anyway, as I was stayed in the convent for several years, Mother Superior continued to pressure me and to tell me that if I ever dared or attempted to run away from this convent, it would be very serious. And she told me my life would be a life of penance and a life of suffering because I had attempted to run away from a convent. Well, I understood that and I expected it because I'd lived in the convent for 20 years, 22 years, and I know their tactics, I know what they do, how they live, know how they operate, and it doesn't take 22 years to find out all of the things I had to find out. And so it was tragic. And the penances they placed upon my body was something terrible. And I told you a little bit last night about being so hungry because we just had 10 cups full of coffee with a piece of bread that weighed 4 ounces for our breakfast, no lunch. And for our evening meal, we have half a slice of bread weighing 2 ounces and 10 cups full of black coffee. And that's our evening meal. And you're always very, very hungry. Now, I told you last night how I took that piece of bread. I stole it, the potato skins, rather, out of the garbage can. I put them in there, but I took them out. And, you know, I pressed them out real flat in my skirt so the Mother Superior wouldn't see them or observe them. Because when we march out of the convent from doing our kitchen work, she goes down the sides of our skirts to be sure there's nothing in our pockets. And I had smoothed them out so smooth she didn't observe them. I waited until we got in ourselves that night. And the doors were locked. And at 9 o'clock, the lights are all out. And all the little nuns are locked in their cells. And then I attempted to eat my potato skins. And don't think I didn't eat them, because I did. Every one of them. I was so very, very hungry. Now, in the cell, after we've taken our perpetual vows or black veil that I gave you last night, we have, I finish my potato skins. First, we have to kneel and pray. And it's a prayer board over there at the head of the bed. And it's just two boards running straight up and down, then one about this long, about this wide, down where I'm going to prostrate myself on my knees and my hands crossed like this. And so as I prostrated my hands and I dropped down on that board, I didn't realize what I was dropping down on, because there were hundreds of little sharp edges of tacks or nails or whatever they could have been that were driven through that board, and I dropped down on those. And let me tell you, the pain was terrific. That doesn't make any difference. That's a part of our penance. We're taught to believe that makes us holier, and it makes God happy to. And we haven't any better sense than to believe it. We don't believe it after we're there for a period of time. But you have to accept it anyway. And it's very painful. Very painful. All right. So because I took that piece of bread the following morning, the Mother Superior said we're going to be penitent. And I didn't have any idea what the penance was going to be there. You asked no questions. You wouldn't get any answers anyway. And she took me into a penance chamber. And there she tapped a bell. It brought me down to the middle of the room, nearly down to the front. And she tapped a bell, and two little nuns came. And either of them were given a piece of rope. And my hands were tied behind my back very securely. And my feet were tied together. Then the Mother Superior said to one of the nuns to reach up and get a hold of my nostrils and just hold it tight. And, you know, you can't breathe very long with your nostrils being held tight. You can breathe through your mouth a little while. But it wasn't long. And the Mother Superior had everything prepared. And next thing I observed, they were giving me something. And it was a tablespoonful of hot cayenne pepper. And when they put that in my mouth, you have to swallow whether you want to or not. You can't breathe otherwise, because I'm still holding my nostrils. But I had to swallow it. And, oh, I was one sick person for a number of days, violently ill. Wished, prayed to die. Wished I could die. But anyway, God didn't see fit for me to die. It was a terrible thing. Well, because I was hungry, and we do, I don't know of a night you ever go to bed feeling comfortable in your stomach because you haven't had enough food. You work very hard. And we're skinny as we can be as it is. We have nothing to go on. And the next thing I saw was just a piece of bread laying on the table. And I saw it several days laying on the table with a crust of bread or heel of bread. And I stole that. That's what she said I did. She called it stealing. And so I'm just telling you what she said. And you know, this time, now how she found out that I took the potato skins, I cannot tell you because I don't know myself. Neither do I know about the piece of bread. But the next morning she said, we're going to do penance about 9 o'clock. Well, I knew that that was out of order. That wasn't the morning for penance, and I know something's wrong. And then immediately I thought, who in the world saw me take that bread? But anyway, she said, we're going to do penance. They took me into another big powerful room, one I'd never been. This is all underground, one story underground. When she took me in that room, I shall never forget, they had a table up near the front, very much like your kitchen table. And she brought me up there, and she had me to stand right here on this side of the table, over by the side of it like this. And she told me, now, there's no lights in that room except some candles on a candle holder, 7 lights. And they were in the back, so you know there wasn't much light in the room. And you have to stand there a while before you can observe anything to be able to see. But she said to me, you lay your hand, just the hand and the wrist, on the table. And when I did, it was a flat board about that long and possibly that wide and maybe about that thick through. And that's what I laid my hand and wrist on. And as I laid it there, held it there, his mother was over here on this side. And just a few moments, something was happening. Right down in front of me, here comes something. And as it got right in front of my face, I saw it. And it was a board just like the one my hand and wrist is lying on. And that mother brought it right on down. It is a vice. And she brought it right on down. She controlled it from over here. And she could let that come on down on my hand and wrist. And she just kept screwing that vice a little bit tighter. And you know, after all, I'm a human being, and I feel just as much as you feel. And I thought she was going to crush every bone in my hand. The pain was beyond human endurance. And I went out like a light and fell to the floor. And there was nothing I could do. I'm hanging there just by the hand and the arm and suffering some, well, something that you don't know anything about. And I don't know how long they left me hang. You have no way to know those things. But the pain I went through, I can assure you, was enough pain for the rest of your life. Oh, it was a terrible, terrible pain. And she said, I stole that piece of bread. Well, maybe that's stealing, but I got it out of the garbage can. The potato skins, and the bread would have gone in the garbage can and left the convent, and it would have done no one any good. But she called it stealing. Well, anyway, as I continued to live in the convent, so many things like this happened because she said your life's going to be a life of penance, a life of suffering, and so on and so forth. Oh, now, it certainly was. Everything that woman could think of to inflict on my body, seemingly she inflicted upon me. Oh, one day we have no hair on our head. You've already heard that. The hair is cut off of our head. They put a pair of clippers on every 3 months, and we're bald-headed. And you know, the Mother Superior, on certain days during the Lenten season especially, they would always come and put a crown of thorns on our head. Now, they didn't put it on our head to look pretty. They didn't put it on our head because we're going someplace, because we were not. And then after they put the crown of thorns on your head, and they don't put it on gently, it's very painful and a lot of pain connected with it. And then the cross is between 6 and 8 feet tall, made from a heavy timber. And then she hangs the cross over my shoulder. Well, now my body's already broken. How in the world does that woman expect to, I'm supposed to call that cross, pull that cross, about 6 feet this way, then up over 2 steps and all the way. I never got up to the steps with it. I went to the floor. I'd fall under it, and my crown of thorns would bounce off of my head. But she'd pick it up and put it right back on my head and put the cross back on my arm or shoulder and compel me or try to compel me to drag it. I never was able to drag it but just a few steps. But oh, how painful. How painful it was is something you'll never forget. As long as I live, I surely will never forget it. And it makes the reality of knowing how Jesus carried that cross to Calvary for me. It does something to me every time I read that scripture. I hear pushing on crucifixion on the cross. It just does something to me. It just melts my heart. Because I had just an inkling. Now I surely had not the suffering he had. But I have an inkling and knowing what he must have gone through and how he must have suffered for you and for me. Well, that woman continued to inflict penances upon my body. Just one after another. Seeming you didn't get over one, till something else was being inflicted upon my body. She was doing that trying to break me down. She said I had a stubborn will. Well, you have a stubborn will, I expect, if you lived in a place like that and it made you do things you knew that were wrong and made you do so many things that were abnormal, it would cause anyone to have a stubborn will. But I knew I had to do them, and I did them, and went through the agony and suffering of it, and it broke me. And she knew that's exactly what she wanted in the beginning. You say, what is her motive for all of these things? Well, the only reason they tell us, pardon, is that we are supposed to imitate the passions and the sufferings of our lovely Jesus. And of course, our life is supposed to be a life of prayer, meditation, devotion, and study to win souls. Now, if you can win souls and live under those kind of conditions and half starve to death, you don't have anything left inside of you to even want to win a soul. Surely we prayed. We had to, whether we wanted to or not, on our rosary beads. I wore out so many sets of rosary beads. Same old prayers all the time, but my, they didn't mean a thing. You get something completely dead.